David Lichtenstein, and welcome to the Yeshiva Shalmaila. This week we have an interesting program, new research about the famous Sheitel controversy. In fact, we're going to be doing a few shows on Sheitel. We're going to be speaking about the wigs from India, and we're going to be speaking about the different menhagim. People do wear it, don't wear it, Sfaradim don't, Ashkenazim do, many don't wear it at all. They don't believe in, they believe in Giluach HaRosh, but Chassidim. We'll see if we can get somebody from there to talk about as well, the different menhagim. But this program will be about Indian hair. And we have a, put together a wonderful group of guests, Rabbi Mordechai Kuber, who we all have Hakaras HaTov for. He's one of the translators and authors of the Pirush of the Art Scroll Shas, which I use every single day practically. Well, and he's works for the OU as well. He's been a Rav in two communities. Today he's a Rav in Eretz Yisrael. We will have Rabbi Shmuel Yitzchak Friedman, who wrote a sefer on it called Pas Kedma, about the Indian here. He's a Reish Koel in Ramot. And then we will have Professor Emma Tarlow, doctor from England, University of London, who actually wrote a book called Entanglements. She spent 30 years researching Hindi religions. She's an anthropologist, University of London, and she's written a book about human hair. And actually, she said when she printed her book, Rabbi Landau from Bnei Brak called her to quiz her about the details. And then we will have Rabbi Tzvi Weissman from California, who's a Baal Tshuva, who actually spent 6 years in South India involved with this religion, a Hindu religion, who will tell us firsthand, now that he's a Baal Tshuva, what happens at these temples. Now, we ran out of time, so next week I've actually interviewed a number of Hindu priests as well, because there's great uncertainty as to, in other words, many of the Rabbanim we speak to and the researchers say the hair, when they bring it, they have the haircut, it's not meant to be a sacrifice at all. It's a type of cleansing, like Taglachas of Mitzayra, this week's Parsha. What is it? It's a type of purification. Now that you're pure, you can go into the deity, their Getchka. Now, Rabbi Donner, famously, a number of years ago, went to India with a translator who you will hear dubious whether he understood what was going on, and he came back with a chiddush. He said, notwithstanding the fact that Rabbi Moshe was matarit and Rabbi Yashiv initially was matarit, there's a change in the facts. And what is that? He said, even though their kaihanim, etc., their galachim, say that the purpose of shaving the hair is a sacrifice of the human ego, which in other words, a type of tahara, where you diminish your ego before you go into the deity. He said, Rav of the people who are going there are amaratim, and they think they're doing it for a sacrifice. So it's contingent on them. It's not contingent on the kayanim. We will debate this point, right? So these are the facts, some of the facts that we're going to be discussing. We'll be speaking to all these rabbanim. Next week, we'll have an edition on this. So the number one expert in Eretz Yisrael on this. So this week we have a few who are for, one who's against. We will also have a number of priests. Now, my admin at the office, you know, and I said, get me 3 or 4 Hindi priests that I can talk to. She's giving me, you know, these funny looks. It's the second time this happened to me this month. Like, you know, Mr. Lichtenstein, like, is everything all right? You want to speak to Hindu priests? Is there something I should know? And I'll tell you, it's the second time that happened to me this month. I was walking with my Shishchayel in the city, and we passed by a man screaming, I need food, give me food. A poor little African-American sitting on like some type of a crate. My wife looks at it. It was a freezing night. She said, the man's hungry. We got to get him some food. So there was a deli over there, a Trefa deli, a Gaisha deli. I went in. I asked the guy, what do you want? He said, I want a turkey sandwich. I said, okay, I didn't think of it. I went into the deli, it's Trefa deli, and I order a turkey sandwich. And I come out, I give the guy the turkey sandwich, and he starts mumbling, Russian dressing? You know I like it with Russian dressing. I said, I'm sorry, you didn't tell me that. So I went back in. And then he tells my wife, and I want a Coke too. So my wife calls across the floor of this Trefa thing, get him a Coke together with the Russian dressing with the turkey sandwich. Like, oh, yeah, I'm wearing my yarmulke, beard, whatever. And I said to myself, my goodness, somebody could look at this and really get... So we were speaking to the Hindi priest, because when you want to know what they're doing, you have to speak to the Khmer. That's the purpose. So we have really a fascinating show with experts in the field, and I think some of what they say will fascinate you and surprise you. Okay, let's go to the riddle of the week. So here's a riddle. The Mechaba in Taf Ayin Zayin says, in Hilchos Pesach, says you don't make a bracha al achilas afikaymen. We make a bracha al achilas matzah. We make a bracha al achilas mar. We do not make a bracha al achilas afikaymen, even though it's a mitzvah. And the Mishnah Berurah brings on the spot from the Paiskim. He says you don't make a bracha on something that's a zecher ba'alma. It's just a memory, and a memory, it's like a mirage. Why are you making a bracha? So here's the question. Come on, everybody. I'm asking this riddle because it's that time of year. Shulchan Aruch Paskin, Sfiras Aimer Bezman is a drabanan. It's not a daraisa. Not like the Shitas Rambam, etc. And why do we do it? Al Zecher Lamigdash. In fact, after Sfiras Aimer, what do we say? Arachamon Yachslan Avedis Beisha Mejim Herimen Wamein. So it's a Zecher. So we do make a bracha on Sfiras Aimer. So why is it different? And I was learning with my chavrusa, Reb Jacobson, and when I asked him the shaili, he was myself. He said, I have another question. He said, if for a zecher you don't make a bracha, why by the lulav, the last 6 days of Yom Tif, do you make a bracha on that? It's also only zecher lemigdash. So that is the riddle. Let's hear what you have to say. What's the difference between afikayman, you don't make a bracha because it's a zecher, and Sfiras Aimer, as well as Lulav, that you do, even though it's just a Zecher. Okay, before we go to our guests, I want to say a short vart on the Parsha. This week is the Parsha of Tzezriya Metzaira, the Parsha, Chazal say, of Lashon Hara. You speak Lashon Hara, you get Tzaras. And here's a question, and it's a very obvious question, and I didn't see anybody ask it. Why, if you speak Lashon Hara, do you get Tzaras? Maybe your hair should fall out, your tongue should fall out, your teeth should fall out. Anafkimina, soltais, kalamachwa, shesamti b'mitzrayim, soltais, bad things that could happen. Why did they pick the Torah pick of everything, tzaras? And don't tell me because you're going to say because we send the mitzrayim out of the machne, so we also send the baal lashon hara. Good, so you should say the same thing. If you speak lashon hara, your teeth fall out, and anybody whose teeth fall out, or hair falls out, or anafkimina, his eye falls out, or his get sent out of the machna. That's circular reasoning. Why is tzaras that was nikva? Once it was nikva, yes, you send them out. But it could have been anything else. So what is the connection between lashon hara and tzaras? And I want to share with you something that I think is profound and counterintuitive. And I couldn't find the makor for this in Sfarim. And if anybody finds something like this, please let me know. And I also have another question, which is less of a question. If it's Lashon Hara, we know, the 17 Lavan of Lashon Hara is one of the most chamerdik averis, is only for the truth. If you say something bad about somebody and it's a lie, it's not Lashon Hara, it's Maitzi Shemra. So the question, and Maitzi Shemra has much less punishment than Lashon Hara. So why is the truth punished and the falsehood is not punished? Seems counterintuitive. Those are the two questions. Why Lashon Hara gets Tzaras and why is it on a thing? And I want to share with you something. The Declaration of Independence says all men are created equal. And I, David Lichtenstein, say it's the biggest lie, if that's how you understand it. Why? You know, there are not good-looking people. Did you ever see a not good-looking person who looks at a really somebody who's very handsome or beautiful and says, ah, I'm so happy being born not good-looking. Or I'm so happy being born not smart or incapable or maybe financially grew up, I just can't seem to earn a buck. I don't have that like extra seichel that when it comes to earning a dollar, it's a certain like cleverness, a shrewdness, right? You know, or, you know, I'm filled with shame. I struggle. I can't get a job. The job I have is below my neighbor's job, my dignity. What about people, you say all men are created equal? Maybe you grew up with a mother and father who loved you. Don't you know people who grew up with mother and parents who are ashamed of them? Who didn't like them, who regretted having them, who thought their sibling was better. So what does it mean? All men are created equal. All men are not created equal, and usually for no repurpose of their own. Yes, I would like to be beautiful and as bright and an Eloi, and I would have loved to, of course, it was, but nobody gave me a choice. I wasn't part of the lucky club. It's a minority that are. So what does it mean all men are, and the answer is all men are not created equal. So I want to ask you, that person who's looking for a shidduch and can't find the shidduch, maybe because his parents fought horribly at home and he just has no faith in getting married, right? Or maybe his father or mother or father went to jail and he's humiliated and nobody wants to read him a shidduch. Or maybe he's just not smart, or maybe he's ugly, or she, etc., or has a weight. So many tzaras. How do they get up in the morning? I mean, today with social media, Madison Avenue, you open up, the world is full of the most beautiful, handsome, and we idolize them. Do you know a beautiful person could do almost anything, right, and never get criticized, right? So what is a person, how do they get up in the morning? You were born not smart, incapable, not handsome, not career-wise, you didn't get into a good school or a good yeshiva, you couldn't get into the yeshiva you wanted. Your family has shalom bayis tzaris, your father had anger issues. How do you get up in the morning? You know how we get up in the morning? There's something called a brave face. People make a narrative. And they say, you know, it's true, I'm ugly, and nobody wants to go out with me. Right, I don't have hair, I'm over, whatever it may be, some genetic thing, right? But I'm really a deeper person. I'm a more special, maybe because I'm kinder. People make a veneer, a brave face, a narrative that allows them to get up and do what they have to do. Through no fault of their own, who doesn't want to be beautiful? Right? They make a narrative. They make putting on a brave face. And you know the worst thing that you could do? You could look at the person with the brave face and say, what? You think you're like us? You're not. You're an ugly, stupid, dumb schlepper. You come from a... You tear that person's narrative apart and watch them crumble like a china vase that was hit by a baseball bat. And here's something very profound. We have no right, the Torah says, even if it's the only if it's the truth. Because if I think back in my life, or you think back in yours, the most hurtful things, think of the most hurtful thing somebody said to you, it was true. And you had tried to cover it and make a facade over it, a veneer, or ignore it, and the person stuck the knife right in. And that's the most hurtful thing. They destroyed my veneer, my brave face, the facade I try to. And this is counterintuitive because most people think, geez, I'm saying to MS, he's walking around like he's a ganzazach. It's not. Let's say the truth. It's not. He or she, they need that to get up in the morning. And the worst thing you could do is say, Lashon Hara, break that brave face. Let people have their story, their narrative, even if it's a little illusional or delusional. Let them have it. And you know that there are three types of tzaras. There's a tzaras in the basar. Some people aren't. We said they're physically, mentally, the person themselves. No, they're second. The ziburis, they're either bein, it is beininus or ziburis. Maybe the ziburis, it could be personally, or it could be begadav. Maybe he's a fine person, but he's not successful in life, right? He didn't get the shtela, he didn't get the job, he whatever. He's not the most capable person. That's begadav. You could have a neg on the begadav or bebesai. There's no shalom bias. It's a very poor house. Nobody wants to do a shidduch with that house. That's bebesai. All the different delusions. So why does it tzaras? Why do we give tzaras? Let me tell you why. You broke, you shattered that person's facade, and we put a nega on your facade. What's the skin? When you put on makeup, you put on your face, you put on your thing, you brush your hair, you comb your beard, and you go out, your face, pardon him, you show the world. You destroyed somebody else's narrative, somebody else's brave face, somebody's veneer, and we destroy yours. We put a nega on yours. So here it's so ironic and counterintuitive. Yes, let the other person have their story. They really, really need it. Let's me and you stop being such kanoim, who we could rip apart, and let's say, you know what? Your story is a fabulous one. I admire you, thinking, despite what you went through, that you had the courage to get up, and I admire that. And that is, to me, a totally new view look on what is the Isser of Lashon Hara. Let's go to our guests. We have this year. This week we have Eretz Yisrael. Listen to this, Rabbi Kuber from Israel, Rabbi Friedman from Ramot, Professor Tarlow from England, and Tzvi Weissman from the West Coast. So, wow. Let's go to the phones. We have on the phone with us from Irvine, California, Lee/Tzvi Weissman. Welcome, Lee.
Thank you so much.
So happy tell us your. Tell us your story, Lee.
So my story is that I grew up in Philadelphia, and when I went to college, I became interested in South Asian studies and Sanskrit studies. So for, I guess, about 12 years, studied Sanskrit and South Asian studies. I was a PhD student at the University of Chicago in South Asian studies, specializing in South Indian, contemporary South Indian religion. And I was doing I did my PhD work actually in South India. I was in South India for about 6 years. Fluent in Tamil language, and pretty fluent in Sanskrit. Sanskrit's is a written language, not a spoken language.
Considered one of the most difficult languages in the world, am I correct? Sanskrit?
Sanskrit, well, actually, yes, it's difficult. I mean, it has the advantage of being perfect. It's actually a constructed language, not a natural language. So it has a perfect grammar that makes life a little bit easier. But yeah, it's not an easy language. Plus, it's, you know, there's lots of different historical levels to the language and so on. So, but I'm pretty proficient. And so that's where I did my PhD work, was in South Asian studies, specializing in contemporary Hinduism, particularly in South India. And while I was in South India, and it's a long story, that's a whole different story, I became more interested in Judaism, and eventually came back to the United States and studied, and I've been from now for probably 30 years or more.
Wow.
That's my story.
You got your PhD at the University of Chicago, you say?
Right. So I did my work at the University of Chicago, and just short of a PhD, because actually I had my sort of religious epiphany just before I finished my dissertation, decided to kind of retool. Now I'm I teach Jewish studies at a Jewish community high school. I used to teach at EULA University, Yeshiva University of Los Angeles high schools in Los Angeles for many years. So I became a high school teacher. So I kind of retooled myself.
That's amazing.
Changed professions. Yeah.
So you're aware of the Shetal, I'm not sure what the right way to
issue. Shetal, we'll call it
issue. Tumo. Yeah. I don't know how to.
I was very involved in it at the time that it came out with Rav Dimmer, and I was in Israel and spoke with Rav Kanievsky and Rav Rosner, and I did spend quite a bit of time on it at the time. So yeah, I'm pretty familiar with the issue, and very familiar with the place and with what goes on there, and yeah.
So tell us the issue. First, give us a little history, and then afterwards, you'll tell us about what your studies and your time spent speaking Tamil and Sanskrit, how that can enlighten this issue. Okay, but walk us through the issue.
So the issue is that in the city of Tirupati, and there are actually some other places where this happens too, but the main issue was in Tirupati. Tirupati is a pilgrimage spot. In the state of Andhra Pradesh in South India. It's actually a Tamil-speaking region, but it's in Andhra Pradesh, north of Tamil Nadu in South India. And there's a very large and very prosperous temple complex there. It's probably the wealthiest temple complex in all of India, and one of the most popular temples in all of India. And part of the custom of that temple is that people make vows to the god.
What is the name of the temple?
It's usually called Tirupati.
How do you spell that? How would you spell that?
Tirupati. Tirupati.
Tirupati. Okay.
Yeah. It has more. It's the real proper name is the Sri Venkateshwara Temple, but you probably don't want to remember that. So people make vows to the god there. So for example, if you want to pass a test or something, pass a test or business or some kind of, you make a vow, and part of the vow is that you're going to go to Tirupati and you're going to bring some gifts to the temple. And as part of the preparation for this, you give, you offer your hair. Now I use that word offer, not in a technical sense, right? Not in the sense of making an offering, but that you donate your hair. Okay, you donate your hair, knowing that that hair is that the hair is going to be removed from your head, and it's going to be packaged up, and it's going to be sold. Okay,
so who are you offering it to?
This is where the language becomes kind of a problem. So the word in Tamil for that kind of offering, kanika, it really means a donation, right? Not an offering as in a sacrifice. So this becomes a donation to the temple, and it's a preparation, right? It's included along with bathing and various other things that you do in preparation for going to the temple in fulfillment of your vow. But you're not actually offering the hair to the god. That would not be an acceptable offering.
Why wouldn't you offer your hair?
Because the hair is ashuddha, it's tame, right? It's an impure hair, barbers, anything in relation to that is completely impure. They have concepts of purity and impurity, and you would never offer something like
this. Is this Hindi? Like, what religion is this?
Okay, this is Hinduism. This is Hinduism.
And so would you say it's like going to the mikveh, sort of? Like, try to give us some type of a reference.
Right, exactly. It's a kind of hachana, right? And it's like going to the mikveh, and in fact, they actually do bathe. After you get your hair cut, you would actually bathe.
So would it be sort of like a taglachas of a mitzvah? Like, just like a mitzvah, you know, before they're tired, they go to the mikveh, they would shave their heads. Would it be similar?
Right, okay. Very similar to that. Now there is another the other dimension to it is you have to remember that both Indian women and Indian men put a lot of energy into their hair. I mean, say, you know, they often have very long, lustrous, beautiful hair, and it's also a sacrifice of beauty. You know, it is kind of part of it is saying, you know, look, I grew my hair and it was so beautiful, I'm giving that up for you. You know, I'm giving up all of that beauty and coming to you as a simple person. I look like everybody else. And if you've ever seen what bald people look like, you know, everybody kind of looks alike.
No, you would have to imagine. You would have to imagine a taklachas of a mitzvah, especially for an isha, could not have been fun, right?
Right, of course not. Because people, you know, women, they put a lot of energy into beautifying their hair and so forth, and yeah. But this is really also kind of a ritual of humbling. It's kind of and for both for men and women, but certainly for women, as a kind of, you know, you're coming to the temple now humbled in this way.
It's a self-abnegation.
Right, a kind of self-abnegation. Yeah.
Okay. Well, so tell us, continue the story. So Rabbi Donna shows up.
Right. So you know, the story of the investigation of this is kind of fascinating because, so in Rav Duner's case, Rav Duner went with a Jew from Bombay, a Marathi. This will be important. A Jew whose first language was Marathi, his second language was English, and his third language was Hindi. Okay,
yeah.
So that's his third language. The people who he was communicating with, their first language was Tamil. Their second language was English, and their third language was Hindi. So now imagine you have two people who are communicating, both of them in their third language, right? And he's communicating about a topic about which he knows absolutely nothing.
So it sounds a little bit like the Der HaFlaga.
Exactly. Really, like, I can't even imagine these conversations. And when I spoke to him on the phone, I had a fascinating conversation with his translator. So I said to him, I said, listen, you know, when I spoke to Rav Duner, Rav Duner kept saying that you said that they were making an offering, they were making a sacrifice. I said, what word did they use in Hindi? Like, because I do speak some Hindi, so I, you know, my Hindi is not very good, but I know some. So I said, just rehearse it with me. Tell me what they said. And he spoke to me, and I said, I don't hear any word like sacrifice. Any of them don't say it. Like, and he said, it's not like sacrificing a chicken. I said, I wish you had said that to Rav Duner. you know, because that's precisely not the language that they use. And nobody would ever say that it's like sacrificing a chicken. You know, that's like sacrificing it. It's some form of ritual sacrifice. It's not. It's a self-humbling donation, but it's certainly not a sacrifice.
Well, certainly not sacrificing a chicken, because Hinduism is a language that doesn't believe in killing anything live at all.
Well, Hinduism is very funny that way.
When did Rav Dunner arrive in India? Do you know?
I do not remember. I don't remember the dates.
Do you know the date, a week it was?
That I do not know.
Do you know how many days he spent at Tirupati in, you know, speaking to
just,
people?
Just a couple of days. I think it was just a couple of days.
And he was with somebody who didn't speak the language. And you say that he didn't understand that as Tagvachas of Mitzayra, he thought it was actual sacrifice.
Right. And I think part of it is, you know, there's a lot of reasons why, you know, and I did speak to this. I don't think he was so pleased with my speaking about it, but I think part of it is, you know, kind of imagine if a group of Tibetan monks arriving, arriving Motzei Shabbos and seeing Kiddush Levana, right? What would they think was going on there, right? They would look and they'd say, oh, these people are, you know, dancing to the moon, they're praying to the moon. What would they think? Because they don't have access to the text, right? So they don't know what you're reading. They have no idea what it is that you're reciting, right? All they have is kind of like what the context that they're going to provide to it. And I think to a large extent, that's partially what happens above Dunner, is that instead of being able to ask the right questions and also to talk to the right people, you know, I mean, and to speak to people in the language they understand and so forth, and to understand what's being said to him, you know, that didn't happen. And also, there's also another interesting, there's also a peculiar dynamic that happens. You know, I don't know, Indian society is very stratified. And there's a peculiar feature of Indian communication that if a person is perceived as being superior, you can never say no to them. So if Rav Dunner, who is is by Indian standards a very impressive looking religious
white man
comes along and says, and points to somebody's shirt, and the shirt is yellow, and he says, what a beautiful black shirt, the person will nod and say, yes, it's a beautiful black shirt. Right? It literally, you could say that white is black and black is white, and you would not be contradicted. So that creates an interesting problem, because what would happen is that Rav Dunner would say, so this is like, and the person would say, yes, you know. The same thing happened. The same thing happened with the B'nai Brak investigation, but to a completely different conclusion. The B'nai Brak investigation came to the conclusion that a trash can was a god. First of all, do you know the word? What does the word pushka mean? What does pushka?
Pushka means a little box.
Right. It means a little box. Exactly. Okay. So. It means a little tin box. That's the basic meaning of the word pushka. So the basic meaning, so there is a charity box in Hindi is called a hundio. It's called a hundi. And the word hundi means a metal box. Okay? It means a metal box. That's all it means. Right? So something which is used to hold charity and something which is used to hold trash, called by the same word, hundi, which means a metal box. So they were at the center where they collect the hair, and so the barbers were shaving off the hair, and they were tying them into bundles, and they were chucking them into stainless steel barrels, into stainless steel, trash cans, essentially. And So the guy who was investigating, who was an Israeli guy who spoke like 15 words of Hindi. I actually got to hear, he was very nice. He actually recorded the entire thing, right? He actually recorded the entire thing. So I heard the entire recording. So I got to hear I got to hear everything. And so he goes and he asks, what's that you're putting it in? And the person says, it's a hundi, right? It's a hundi, which means it is a metal basket, right? Which is exactly what it is. It is a metal basket. And so, but he had heard that there is a famous hundi in Tirupati, inside the inner sanctum of the temple, right next to the image of the deity. It's a very fancy, it's a very fancy metal box that has on it the image of the goddess of fortune. And it's famous throughout India as being a place that if you give charity there, you'll get a blessing from it, right? And so people are very particular that they go into the inner sanctum of the temple and they bring their gifts into the inner sanctum of the temple and they put it in that hundi, right, in that particular box, because that's a very special thing. So he had heard about this hundi. So now, in his mind, right, he now knows, he's thinking that hundi is that, he now thinks that this stainless steel box is now the same as that very famous one in the middle of, at the center of the temple. And so he doesn't know the difference. And, so he says, oh, that's the hundi. And the guy says, yes, that's the hundi. Partially because he has no idea what he's talking about, right? Because for him, it's a metal box. And he doesn't know that he's talking about the hundi. And he goes on about, and the guy just kind of clearly has no idea what he's talking about. He just keeps going, yep, whatever you say, sure, yes. And so he comes to the conclusion that this metal can that they're throwing the hair in, which is the stainless steel can that they're throwing it in, is the incarnation of the goddess Lakshmi, the goddess of fortune, and that these people are getting some great blessing out of it. So I spoke, and just to make sure that.
Now, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Is your expertise because you read up about this, or is this part of your training in part of your doctorate? Like, is your knowledge
okay.
here? Like, how thorough is your knowledge here about what goes
okay,
on?
Okay, so there are a couple of reasons. So one is that my specialty was South Indian temple religion, so I knew a lot about it. The other thing is also I spent a lot of time in that particular temple, partially because I was affiliated with the university in Tirupati. So I had to be in Tirupati quite a lot, and there's nothing else to do in Tirupati. That's all there is. The god of Tirupati was actually the chancellor of the university that I was associated with. Try to figure out how that works.
Wait, say, did you say the god of the university?
Yeah, no, the god of the temple is officially the chancellor of the university that I was affiliated with.
How could a god be a chancellor? I'm not following.
Yes, well, this is why we don't do a Vodazara. It's very complicated. Yeah, so basically he is the titular head of the university, and every day they would read him the newspaper, and they would go before the god and read the minutes of the board meetings and things like that. Yeah, it's very so. Really interesting. They treat the god like a real person. So I spent a lot of time in Tirupati. So I was pretty familiar with the place. And certainly, I had been to the hair center many times. I knew where, I knew the procedure that people go through. I've been there so many times. So that was partially.
So Mr. Weissman, so according to what you're saying, the entire concept is based upon really very shoddy legwork, and any conclusion they come to, it's basically you could stick it into a yundi, which means a trash can. Is that what you're saying?
Into the hundi. Yeah, I'll tell you. So
they weren't mekayim having misunim bedin. Be careful when you pop
right.
in something.
I think to really down the school, I think that they really were trying to. I think that they just did not have a lot of information. It took 2 or 3 days to find me. Right? It wasn't that hard, right? sooner or later somebody's saying, you know, is there from guy who has experience, whatever, they found me. And, you know, it would have been, we could have saved ourselves a lot of problems, you know, had they kind of, you know, taken a little bit of time, looked for somebody who, I don't know if I'm a Muslim exactly, but maybe you could say so, you know, and, you know, that would have been a very good move.
And what did he say, when you told him what you thought, what happened?
I'd rather not go into all that. It was very, he apologized. He was a little impolite. And he definitely apologized.
But did he change his psak or no?
No, in the cases, when I went to Eretz Yisrael, and I spoke, because Rav Dunner was not there, Rav Yashuv would not meet with me directly. So I had to operate through intermediaries, and literally it was crazy, honestly. I communicated by phone with one of his lieutenants and kind of like, you know, the information was kind of, it was a little bit secondhand, third hand. He didn't want to meet with me directly, but he was taking in the information. And I'm not sure how that concluded. Rav Kanievsky was a little bit different. I did meet with him directly, but I also spent a lot of time with one of his dayanim and really with the help of Rav David Morgenstern, who was amazing. And if any person really understands this issue, he's the one who understands the issue better than anybody else. It's really quite something. And he worked with me, and we really, I think, spent a lot of time with one of the dayanim of Kanievsky, who I think really got it. I mean, he took the time to really understand what I was saying, to understand, you know, the kind of details and to see it fresh. He was not actually wedded to what they had done, which was very nice. I think he understood that there were some issues with the process and was able to kind of get that maybe there were, you know.
And did they change the psak?
Yeah, so I think Rav Kanievsky did. I don't know that he changed. It's a good question. I don't know.
Okay.
I'm not sure whether he actually. I'm not sure whether they actually changed the psak or not.
Okay.
Certainly, I think what really happened in Taklis is they started to put hexes on shape. I mean, that's, I think, kind of the way it works.
Uh-huh.
And well, I spoke to Rav Lozner directly also. So.
And what did he say?
I think he actually changed. I think he's. I'm almost sure that he actually changed the sock. I think the question that we should all be asking going forward is, you know, how do we use this particular case? To understand, you know, to really think about how we investigate, you know, shilas that, you know, involve exotic information, you know, and I think that this is a case where instead of people saying, you know, hey, we're kind of out of our element here, and, you know, we need help, we need to kind of look for, you know, we look for people from the outside who can help us to be able to understand this issue a little bit better, you know. And talking about people's money. I mean, there are, you know, thousands of dollars at stake here, you know. And it was worth spending another day or two to find somebody who knew what they were talking about, you know, or at least somebody who spoke the language. I mean, my goodness, like, you know, and I think part of it is just not having these issues. But now that we live in a globalized world, you know, and you worry about, you know, you worry about in other areas too, in areas of kashrus and things like that. Like, how are people communicating? You know, are they really understanding the things that are being told to them? And in this case, you know, it's a little bit of a Keystone Cop thing. You know, if you come to the conclusion that the trash can is a god, you know, well, something's really wrong with your process. You know, there's something really went wrong with the process. And both of them went wrong, badly wrong, really badly wrong.
So, see, why did Rav Elyashiv write that letter? How did he make that, according to you, that mistake? If it's so clear that it's not a sacrifice, why would he assume that way? Like, why didn't you tell him something?
What was going on around Gdol Yisrael in terms of their handlers was a little scary. I do not believe that Rav Elyashiv ever saw anything that Rav Dinner was presenting. I have no evidence that's true, but I sincerely doubt it. I think
based on what?
Because at no point was he ever involved in the process. Like, it was very clear. It seemed very clear to me that all the stuff about, oh, I can't talk to you because I'm trying to have dinner, all that stuff was just in order to keep it away from him. That I doubt that he ever saw it. I mean,
so who was running the process over there?
Rav Efrati. Efrati.
Yeah.
He and Rav Dinner were completely behind the whole thing. And
so why didn't Rabbi Morgenstern speak up?
So he did. I mean, he tried. He really tried. I mean, he really tried.
And they squelched him.
But right, and it was, and the politics, what was going on, just in general, you know, to get access, and you know, and I will say this, you know, Rav Vosner's situation was completely different. I mean, he was like hands on, asking questions, right in my face, really sort of. Clearly looking to see who I am, and it was a very entirely different experience. You know, there were no handlers. You know, there was no, you know, but it was a little disheartening. To see that. It really felt like the process at, you know, was, there was a lot of political intrigue in the process, and that was not. You know,
did you feel that they had a conclusion already in their mind and they were sort of disinterested in the facts?
Very much so. I mean, it was, especially because the facts were, you know, at various points, and, you know, I noticed that there was a moment when the Dayan that I was meeting with Kanansky kind of turned, and he was like, you know, he suddenly looked at me and said, yeah, our picture is completely wrong, right? Like, we just got it wrong. Said, yeah, he just got it wrong. And he kind of got that. But there was a lot of holding on to, and especially with Rav Dinner, holding on to what just didn't make sense in context. It just didn't, you know, it's just not the way it was, you know. I mean, you know, and some things, like, you know, I mean, I really did check. I mean, and I tried to, you know, there, the whole thing, oh, yeah, well, you know, there are people who bring their hair into the temple. It's like, no, they're not. I mean, you know, I called the priests. I literally called Peter Bhatti, spoke to the priests on the phone, you know, and I spoke to the priests who, you know, and I spoke to the people who actually empty out the donation boxes. And I said, does anybody ever put hair? Have you ever seen hair? The guy said, no. The worst I've ever seen is a live turtle.
What do you say here? You mean in the temple, you mean?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's if they had brought it into the inner sanctum as an offering to the deity, that would be an entirely different issue. And I think that's a whole different level. That would be, that'd be its crows of a desire for sure. Not for sure, but in any case, you know, it could be for sure. But this, though. No.
Thank you very much, Lee, for your time.
Okay.
I really appreciate it.
Okay, my
All
pleasure.
The best, take care. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
We have on the phone with us from Eretz Yisrael, Rabbi Shmuel Yitzhak Friedman. who wrote a kuntris called Pa'as Kedma about the Whigs, the Shetlach from India. Welcome, Rabbi Friedman.
Shalom Ubracha.
So, Rabbi Friedman, we had on with us a Baal Tshuva who actually lived in India for many years, and I should say for a while, and he speaks Tamil and Hindi, and he said that those who believe it's Avodah Zarah are mistaken, and he said that when Rabbi Zuna came to Israel and they sent Shluchim, they brought people who don't speak the language, who it's a foreign language to them, who were speaking to a language that was not the first language of the people they were interviewing, and came away with totally distorted story. And really, it's more like Taglachas of Mitzayra, where it's considered, the hearer is considered something ugly and disgusting, and you get rid of it, and then you could go to the temple. And people who believe otherwise just, they don't have their facts right. How do you respond to that?
A few points. First of all, there, just to get things straight, before Rabbi Donner went to India, the Rav Nissim Karelitz of Beis Din sent someone a week earlier who was also a Baal Tshuva from Eretz Yisrael. His name is Amir Deromi. He spent a full week in India. He lived 7 or 8 years of his life in India previously. And he went there also for a full week, and he came back with his version of the facts, very, very similar to Rabbi Donner. Now, if we're holding in Tavshin Samach Dalet, like, 2004, that was the case on hand. Meaning, I think I want to start off that I think that there's a very big difference today in 2018 than in 2004. In 2018, if a person wants to find out details of a religion that 850 million people believe in, I think the first step, you do is you research it on the internet. You don't necessarily have to go down to the location or whatever. You could that's the next step. I think the first step is to research it on the internet. If you make a Google search, anyone could do this. You can make a Google search, search the Tirumala Temple Tansur. Tansur means what they call cutting off their hair. I'm telling you that the first 40, 50 Google results all go ahead and, they're very, very well detailed. They have an entire story, how once upon a time this Avodah Zarah was going somewhere and it got hit by a shepherd and he became bald in a certain spot. And another Avodah Zarah came and shaved off his head and gave to that Avodah Zarah. And basically the Avodah Zarah said that anyone who comes to his location and gives hair, he will accept the hair. This is on Wikipedia, for the page, it's on a Wikipedia page about the temple. This is the detail. The temple actually has a website that gives information of the times of when the holes are open to get your hair cut, and it has this story on that page over there. It's all over the internet, not one place, not two places, in tons and tons of places. The nusach on the temple's website basically is, basically, it says this whole entire story, and it continues on that it's also symbolic because by shaving one's hair, one is removing oneself from his ego.
Right. That everybody agrees on. Whereas
okay.
It's leaving your ego so that you can meet the Avodah Zarah without your ego. Is that how you would understand it?
Well, I'm just saying that they go ahead, they give an entire story about giving the hair because the Lord one time lost its hair. And now he needs it, basically. And because of that, they come and they give it here. So this is all over the internet.
But let's go back to what you just said. It's about leaving your ego, right?
Yeah. That's
what does that mean?
So let me finish. Basically, I would give a mashal. Why does someone do? Why do we do a Karban Pesach? We go around and ask 100 yidden why we do Karban Pesach. You know what they'll answer? The pasuk says, "Asher pasach, right? Abatei b'nei Yisrael." The reason why we do a carbon pesach is there's all sorts of reasons, right? The pasuk says, "Beferish," that we go and do a carbon pesach because HaKadosh Baruch Hu was pesach on the houses of Klai Yisrael, right?
Right.
Does that mean it's not a carbon? I'm saying that there's tamim of a mitzvah, and then there's the reason why we do a mitzvah. That's by Yiddishkeit. So have the alav dalis, right? So by them also, they have this whole entire story. And they go ahead and they continue on the story. I'll read the Lashon on the website. As here, basically, it has the whole story. And it continues on that the Lord saw the sacrifice of the other Lord. He says all here given to him by devotees and through Ramallah belongs to the Zavei Dezara. And then it continues in the next sentence, giving our here to God is a symbol of leaving our ego.
Right. So my question is, what does that mean to you?
So that's what I want to say. Basically, you can't disregard the first half. The first half is saying that the Zavei Dezara has a reason why he wants to hear. It's not saying that removing the hear because here is tummy. It's saying, no, the Zavei Dezara wants to hear. That's klar. Now, you want to know
but
why.
Wait. So, Rabbi Friedman, what did they take the hear and they used to throw it in the garbage until recently, right?
Oh, 1 second. Slow down. That's not. We'll get to that in a second. The point that they're giving the here is because this is the reason why they have such a mitzvah.
Because they want it. They want it. What was the word with the ego? What was the exact language?
The ego is not. Before the ego, before we get to the ego, I want to. The first has an entire story how that way the Zara lost here, so
right.
Before they all come and give their here. Meaning that right, there is some. To go ahead and say that there's no shaykhis between. To say that it's like, you know, just removing ego, that's not just that. They say that. They say this whole story why the Zara needs here, and then they have this whole symbolic reason. Why it's like leaving the ego. So it has both halakim. It does say the ego thing, but it says it makes a much bigger emphasis how the Avodah Zarah once lost here and you're giving it here. So, you know, so you can't, to say that it's you know, to become something to be to crave as Avodah Zarah, I'm saying you can't disregard that they're doing it for some sort of tzarech, for the Avodah Zarah. It's not just for this ego purpose. You know, it could be, you could say that this ego thing is, in their world, like...
Well, I'm just saying, all the places I've seen, and I'm on the internet as we speak, see, it has to do with sacrifice of the ego. Well, that doesn't sound like a sacrifice to the Avodah Zarah, which is exactly what this guy said. He said, you have to be mevatel, you have to lose your ego, you have to lose your gaiva. He said, it's like taglachas of mitzvah. Take this part of yourself that you're most proud of, and after you do that, then you could come in front of the Avodah Zarah, which is really what they do. They do it not b'makim the Avodah Zarah, they shave, and then they go to where the Avodah Zarah is, and until recently, when they realized the hair was valuable, they used to throw the hair in the garbage, whereas they would not take takrivis to the Avodah Zarah and throw that in the garbage. Something that's takrivis to the Avodah Zarah is considered special. So doesn't that seem to you to be a little problematic?
Can we go back a step?
Sure.
What's the definition of takrivis to Avodah Zarah?
A sacrifice to the Avodah Zarah.
Sacrifice as opposed to, I'm saying what?
When you give food to the Avodah Zarah, it's feeding the Avodah Zarah, right?
That's
when you bring a carbon, it's called lahavdol lefnim. Like Gemara says, by lefnim, it's karbani lachmi. When you taglachas of mitzayro, going to the mikveh to wash you of dirt, to come to the makam, is not considered. That's sort of a prerequisite of the removal of filth. As opposed to a sacrifice. Do you see the difference in that?
No. So the krevis of a desire is not so black and white. The krevis of a desire is also anything you shecht. The shame of a desire.
Same idea. What is a carbon? A carbon is something that is a sacrifice that is brought up as a reach lichayach in front of the avodah zarah. But Rashi's lashon is, by takrevis l'avodah zarah, is that it is something that is sort of a doyrin l'avodah zarah. How could you say that the hair is a doyrin when they throw it in the garbage and it's considered unclean?
Because the Karevis of Avodah Zarah could be anything that's done, the mitzvah of Avodah Zarah that has a Maisa Kein Shvira. Avodah Zarah doesn't need to want it, and it doesn't need to get to the Avodah Zarah.
But it has to be a type of either. You don't see the difference between a carbon and a doyrein, and when you have to wash off dirt to come in, you don't see a difference?
I'm saying I'm saying if that's done, the mitzvah of Avodah Zarah. The Gemara says,
right.
And it has a Maisa Kein Shvira, then it's the Karevis of Avodah Zarah. There's two Tanayim. There's a Tanai that has to be Avodah Zarah, meaning anything that's a mitzvah from the Avodah Zarah. This is a mitzvah that Avodah Zarah has to do. And it has a mitzvah of cutting it, then it's the Krevis Avodah Zarah. It doesn't matter. It's a halacha. It's a halachic.
If I ask you a question, if somebody had dirt attached to their face, and the only way to get clean was to cut it off, you would say that's also Takrevis Avodah Zarah?
If there's an Avodah Zarah in the world that says that to washing off dirt in your face, and there's a Maisa Kein Shvira, which doesn't have over there, but let's say
no
there'll be a Maisa Kein Shvira. Meaning, to crave the Avodah Zarah would have a mitzvah, to shake lulav, and you go ahead and smash a lulav.
But that's not takrivis. That is the sacrifice, how you're over the Avodah Zarah. Takrivis, Rashi and the Rishonim define, is a doyrin l'Avodah Zarah. So I'm asking you, how could something be called a doyrin when it's thrown in the garbage as a prerequisite to coming to the Avodah Zarah?
So second. Before we're getting to the point, throwing the garbage. Throwing the garbage is also no shaychus. After it's nasa mitzvasa, they're makbet to put it into a certain box called the hundi box, which they hold as the kli kibul of the avodah zarah, and after that they throw it out. Basically, the hundi point is they believe, and like you could go ahead and look this on the internet, that there is a certain hashba'ah that happens when you put it into this hundi. It says on the temple's website that if you're unable to make it to the temple, you could send your hair to have someone else put it in there. You have any explanation for that?
Well, you have to send me that, because so far everything I've seen on the website said differently. It said it's a sacrifice. It said it's a sacrifice of the ego, which is a very big difference. That's all. So
I'm telling you that there's 100 Mekairis that has this entire story that the god lost its hair, and they're giving the hair to the god. That's very black and white. I don't hear too stuff. And they include something of the ego. That's very nice. But you can't disregard the first half. It's all over the internet.
So you don't find the fact that they throw it in the garbage as a problem?
It's basically, if I could give another mushel, they, in their belief system, once it's done, once it's off your head, that's the avoid. After that, it has no significance. I'm saying, by, you know, the dam of the Mizbeach, after it goes to Nachal Kidron, is also sold. It's meaning, once it's nasa mitzvasei, lahavdil, right? But once it's nasa mitzvasei, in halacha, that's it, then that's considered to create with avoid desire. The Rashba says in Avodah Zarah Nun Aleph Amud Beis, he talks about the lechem, that the Avodah Zarah is misratza, that you put it in front of it, even if afterwards you take it away, it's a krevis Avodah Zarah, since Avodah Zarah is misratza, that you put it in front of it. Meaning, there's a certain seder hadvarim, they have a certain, you know, thing they do, and when they're done, it's done. But it doesn't, as far as the halacha is concerned, it doesn't have a significance. You know
what this guy said? He said it would be like somebody coming to America, Octarot Yisrael, and seeing the Yidden make Kiddush Levana, and they would say, how do you explain anything but that the Jews believe that the Levana is God, and therefore the Levana is an Avodah Zarah, and the Jews serve the Avodah Zarah, and a Raya Brura, thousands of Jews stand outside and dance in front of the Levana.
Let's sum a tip to the Raya, I'm sorry.
Okay. So Ramesha was matter it, right?
Says who?
Oh, it's famous. Ramesha was brought in front of Ramesha's Talmidim Amid, and he said it's not a problem.
I don't know. You have to know what the mitzvah is. Three things. I'm saying, look, a certain sefer says this, b'shem Rabbi Limalach Bluth, b'shem Ramesha. I spoke to Rabbi Limalach Bluth. He has no recollection of hearing such a thing before Tavshin Samach Dalet. I'm saying, you know, I don't know.
So if we had somebody who Ramesha would be moderate, would that make you satisfied then?
Well, first of all, I'm saying, look, you know about the Chuvah and Igros Moshe that it says you're not being Samech and it's stuck him without Makaris. You have to know what the Matthias has brought in front of them, because Rav Yashav himself was Matir in Tav Shinnun, right? You can't.
So what changed for Rav Yashav and Tav Shinnun to afterwards?
I'm sorry there. We'll get to that in a second. I'm just saying that, you know, you have to first know how the Shiloh was presented, what were the facts given to him, before you go ahead and be Samech on a Chuvah from Moshe. Okay. Moshe writes in Igros countless times, so you can't be Samech and it's stuck him. You don't know the reason, because you don't know if the reasons are going to apply. So it's a strickle, you know, it's a nice way out to say, oh, we have Ramesha, so we don't have to worry about the sugya. But I'm telling you, that's not, you know, if you go ahead and tell me that someone brought to Ramesha and he told them the Metzias that there's a whole story that the Vaidazar lost its hair and wants its hair, and Alpha Begin, I hear it, I'm saying, be Mavara the Shmua firsthand, and we'll see. I'm saying, Mitzab the sugya is very schwer to say that there's a Starka Heter.
Let's start at the beginning, okay? The Lashon Rashi in Yevamos on Daf Kuf Gimel is that Takrivis is exact Lashon Rashi.
Is
Dairin L'Avodah Zarah, right?
Yeah.
It's not enough that it be Dairin, right? It also have to, since it's not Derech of Lefnim, so it has to be Derech of Lefnim, the Takrivis. So it has to be either Derech Zvicha, Derech Zrika, or Derech Haktara. Right, but the definition of takrivis is something that is a daira in l'avodah zarah, right? So it's true if you give the avodah zarah the daira, and after he's this ratzu with it, it was like you say dasa mitzvah, he's finished with it, right? You did it. It was a daira, and it was derech zricha haktara or zrika. Then you have the tsnayim of takrivis l'avodah zarah. That's one. Additionally, it has to be something, even if it's Derech Zvicha, the Shulchan Aruch Paskins, it has to be something that it was Derech for this type of Avodah Zarah, a Derech of Avodah, of this Avodah Zarah. So, for example, we Paskin like Rashi, that if you shaver Makel in front of an Avodah Zarah, that it's not Avodah Sebekach, that also doesn't help. So it has to be both, there's many conditions, right?
I'm saying, look, I could give you a lot of examples from Chazal and Rishonim, the things that are not mamish a doyrin. Not the mice of making it a doyrin goes ahead and makes it the kibbutz of a desire. But I'm just saying, going back to the case, if anything that is a mice of chaticha, the mitzvah of the avay desire, the thing that comes from the mice of chaticha kibshutei is the kibbutz of a desire.
That is true. Hello, that is the Miri says beferish that anything that's a maisa chaticha or a maisa gziza would have a din of zvicha. There's no doubt about that.
Right. Okay.
But the issue here is that if they're doing it as removal of dirt, if they're doing it as oifen of tahara, right? It's not a takrovis.
If the Avodah is giving a tzivoy to go ahead and cut their hair, why are we handling the time and why he's doing it?
I'm telling you, is taglachas of mitzayra and avoda?
First of all, kibshut, just because I'm saying you're being medama, I'm saying you don't. It's that's not the case. Kibshut, the pashas, the taglachas of another pashas is taka an avoda. The sar of another is aser brahana, and as it mitzvah says v'sreifa, like the chalakim of a carbon.
The taglachas of a mitzayra is a seder of tahara. It's not considered a doyrin, and it's not a.
This guy said that
it's a ma'isa of tahara. It's not a ma'isa of. You're not serving the avodah zara. You're removing an impediment to coming to the avodah zara. There's a very big difference.
My point is that. By avodah zara, it's much more black and white than by Yiddishkeit. Avodah zara, anything that's a mitzvah of avodah zara that has a maisa of chaticha, that the avodah zara is mitzava, what you cut from that becomes the kravis of avodah zara. Now, if the avodah zara was mitzava for whichever weird reason it was, that's taimei mitzvahs, kipshutai, you don't need a handle with that, just like by Yiddishkeit. Look, the Rambam has very interesting reasons why we bring karbanos also, right? To be marchik the Yitzhar of avodah zara, or the Ramban, because ki'ilu dama. There's also taimei mitzvahs is by Yiddishkeit is a very big side point, but by avodah zara, kipshutai, you shouldn't handle that either. Anything as a maisa chaticha that's betziva by avodah zara, then that's enough to go ahead and become to crave as avodah zara. That's the pashtus. And the kipshutai by parchile anavim, the Gemara on the avodah zara nanav says by cutting the anavim, just by cutting the shame of avodah zara is enough to make the anavim also out of avodah zara without giving them to the avodah zara. There's no tenai of giving it. It's just a maisa chaticha that's done. The shame of avodah zara is also and. Kipshutai, I don't see a reason why we should handle why they're doing it. Just like I'm saying, if you go ahead and start handling karbanos, it's like, yeah, if you're a guy who's handling kiddush levana that your doctor had mentioned, if the guy who's handling kiddush levana would start going, his mishlachas that came to Eretz Yisrael to start handling if kiddush levana is the way they deserve, if they would look at karbanos, I'm sure they'd also come out that they're not really karbanos. Because the Rambam says that the point of karbanos is to be marchik. It's not really giving anything to God. It's just to be marchik a certain yetzahara from Rabbi Dezara. The Rambam. There's all sorts of interesting reasons why we go ahead and do karbanos. And the pasuk even says in the first lamali reis of chaychem. Is also right. The point of a karban is to go ahead and show that you're doing the ratzon Hashem, the lashon of the sefriyas. Yishereich nechayich Hashem. Nachasruach shasisa ratzaincha. Right. The point of a karban by Yid is to go ahead and show that he did the ratzon Hashem. Zehu. Right. So kibshutei by the Zohar is the same thing. It's all learned out. It's all learned out of bilti Hashem levadei is the drasha that we learn out. There's an isser of tekrevis by the Zohar that what's done to Shemayim is also if it's done to by the Zohar. Right. So just like by karbanos, we're not handling the tam, we're handling the mitzvah. So too by kibshutei by the Zohar, we should say the same thing.
So you hold that it's not even a suffix. That the mevinim are right, and that it's not meant as a takrovis, but it's just meant as you hold that all those experts are just it's wrong and it's not a suffix by you.
I said there's two points. First of all, I don't understand in the sugya why you should go ahead and handle the reasons like I just said. The Gemara is left to the Gemara's case. Avodah zarah shavaydasa b'makol. Yeah, Rashi said the case is talking about that it's the avodah was they used to shake a makol in front of it. A guy goes ahead and comes and smashes the makol in front of it, right?
Some type of a takrevis used to break sticks in front of avodah zarah.
No, not the case. No one ever broke a stick in front of avodah zarah. Rashi, the case is avodah zarah shavaydasa b'makol. Rashi says beferish that we're not talking. The avodah wasn't cutting the makol.
The avodah was with kishkush, but takrevis is with shvira.
No, it was. There's nobody who did it. There's no one who did it with a ma'aseh shvira. That's what the Gemara is talking about. This person came and was mishana from it, And he went ahead and broke it. It's us to carry with the way. The Zohar Rashi and all the Rishonim refers, we're not talking about something that anyone else ever broke in front of it. Just because the Lashon of the Ramban is that this Makal, since it's a way the Zohar, has an avoid with this Makal. Makal avoid the Zohar, have a kibahim of the Zohar Acharis.
Right.
So in that case over there, the avoid the Zohar had an in with breaking the Makal. The avoid the Zohar was never commanded and never, no one ever did it before, broke a Makal.
This guy decided to, he thought it was some type of a nice service in front of the avoid the Zohar who liked to bang on the Makal to break the Makal. Yeah.
So first of all, for Kipshute, I will go back a step before, but and every time, avoid the Zohar, you're chayiv if you do the Maisa that the Oivdim do, even without Kavana. Right? And I have it right. Meaning, because Rambam says, you pick up a Levena, the shame being Makabal on Avodah Zarah, you're chayiv, no matter what.
Right.
Anytime you're Makabal, anything given is not Shloika Derech, and you're Makabal by doing any Maisa, then you're chayiv. So the case of the Gemara there is clear, is not talking about that there's any sort of Kabbalah. You're coming, meaning, just like Zarek Evan, the Markoilis, you're chayiv, even if you're Makabal on the Zuyeh, so too, by go ahead and any avodah zarah you go at you do it without any machshavas, you're chayiv. And Chas Chanuch speaks out very clearly in Mitzvah Chavah.
So why is that relevant to this?
So the next step, yeah. So Hayoy Shekain, you go ahead and take it. We're talking about a case of Shviras Makal. If avodah zarah, by a case of Shviras Makal, we're talking about that the guy went and broke it stam without any machshavas. And they were right, because the Gemara says that if you're Zarek Makal b'fan of your putter, you're not chayiv. Now, if he would be throw a Makal, and with throwing it, he'll be Makabal Leleah, then he should be chayiv, just like Kabbal Chayim, picking up a Levena that the Rambam says that you're chayiv. Any Maisa Kol Dehu, you're chayiv picking up. So the case of Shviras Makal is talking about that he did it without Kavana. Everyone used to come there and shake a Makal, and he went and smashed it. So the Makal is also out to carry with the Zarek, even though no one else in that Avodah Zarah's history ever did a Shviras Makal, and Alpha picking the Makal to carry with the Zarek. Why? Because this chayfetz, the Shaykh to the Avodah Zarah, and you did a Maisa of cutting.
Right. So what's your point? I'm not following.
So
what is your
If you go ahead, you'll be standing by this avodah zarah. You know, before you're talking about if the makal is dirt, if it's this or that, all sorts of tainas. No one ever did it before. So how could he? Why is the makal a dirt instead of avodah zarah? You just cracked it.
Well, an avodah zarah whose service is by banging in front of it for some reason we can't understand. With us, who seems to enjoy sticks. So one person banged in front of it. The other guy figured if he likes banging in front of it, he for sure likes if you shecht in front of it, if you break the sticks in front of it. I have no idea. I can't get into the mind of an avodah zarah, but this avodah zarah seemed to have some fixation with sticks. So you could either break the stick or you could bang with the stick. So, Kashifam, I don't understand what you want from that.
A person who did this without any kavana whatsoever, because we were doing with a kavana will be chayav even by zrika, and the Gemara says you're not chayav by zrika. So obviously we're talking about a case that the person did without any kavana. And afapikain. And Afal Pikin, then you're chayiv by breaking it, even though no one ever broke it before. So you see from there, there's no t'nai that the kreves of avodah zarah needs to be something that the avodah zarah wants, something like this. It's any chayfetz that has that's shayach to the avodah zarah. If you do any maisa cutting, your chayiv, that becomes the kreves of avodah zarah. Where do we get these handle rise if it's a...
Because this guy is doing it as when he broke Sheber Makel Lefaneh, it was broken for the purpose of some type of benefit to the avodah zarah, right?
It was a Maisa Chaticha that was done to something the Shaykh that Rabbi desired. So, like,
the way Rabbi Belsky quotes him, he says, he asked Rabbi Tana, what happened between then and now? He says, then they only looked at what the Avodah Zarah, what the true Avodah is, and I wanted to see what the people believed. So he says, if the people are doing it, they're obviously, these people, it doesn't matter. They're delusional, but they're still doing Avodah Zarah, and that's what counts. So Rabbi Tana himself agrees that the experts disagree with him. And if you look at if you look at all the letters about this from Rabbi, there's long tshuvas about this from Rabbi Tiber and the Sat Madai. They all say that this is Avodah Zarah himself doesn't want it, but the people are making a mistake. I'm just quoting what the letters and what Rabbi Dana seems to have said. That's all. He says the people are stupid and they don't know what they're doing.
Okay, look, Rabbi Dana himself does not claim to have ever said that, but fine, you could go ahead and believe that. Their own
okay, now let me ask you another question. That the when they sell it, aren't they being mevatalit?
There is a Gemara that says to kreves avodah zarah in the bittel.
I know. So is that a drabbanan or a daraisa?
All the rishonim words daraisa. The rishonim go ahead and there's a hekesh that's learned out by v'yechum mizif chemesim. By what's the v'yechum mizif v'yechum mizif chemesim taisus and chulin yivgem on the beis taisus and beis aman aleph and avodah zarah taisus rashi and chesam aman aleph in Sanhedrin and quite a few other rishonim remember that the bittel doesn't work me daraisa.
Rabbi Friedman, let me tell you how to an outsider learning the sugya and going through the tshuvas and trying to understand why so many people do it, this is what I would tell you. I would say that for starters, from what I've seen, including from Rabbi Dana, they
one
say
second.
That
certain... What happened? Okay.
One, it seems that the Derech Avoida is not b'chitach, and it's not b'sar at all, right?
Right, okay.
So it's not Takrivus, right? Comes Rabbi Dunner, and he says, no, but the people mistakenly do it for that, right? So the question is, A, did they do it? So you have a suffix, whether they did it or they didn't. So it's a suffix, the Raisa would be
Lachavra.
Right,
yeah.
Right? Right, that would be suffix number one. Suffix number two is that the Shulchan Aruch Nemzan, that if it's not Derech Avodas HaBekach, right, even if you do a Derech Zvicha, still doesn't become a Tarovis. That's the Shulchan Aruch, right? Even though the Torah may argue, that's how the Mechaba Paskins, like Rashi, right? In which case, assuming that the experts say that it's not Derech Avodas HaBekach, that would be a reason to be Matir. Another reason to be Matir. A third reason to be Matir is if it's Ein Derech Avodas HaBekach, so well, the third reason is according to the Shara Melech, who says that Takrovis Avodah Zarah is Aser Rak B'Drabanan, so these all become Sfeikis Drabanan. Now we already have two different Sfeikis, right?
Okay, you let me answer?
Yes, sure.
Okay, number one, Avodah Zarah or not Avodah Zarah is a very black and white thing. Is it something they do or something they don't do? If
right.
Ahead,
well, it's not black and white here because we've been disagreeing about it for half an hour.
Okay,
so it's totally not a black and white thing.
But basically, that Avodah Zarah is mitzvah or something that these people are doing, but Tzivei Avodah Zarah is considered Avodah Zarah. Number two, if someone does something, a Maaseh Chituch, even if it's not Avodah Zarah, because he believes that it is, the Rashi was mefirsh, that it's still considered to carry Avodah Zarah. There's no such klal that Avodah Zarah has to be made up by the head galach. It makes no sense to say such a thing because Avodah Zarah is shtusim, so there's no reason to assume that only the head galach can make up shtusim and the intermediary, the other people.
So how do you understand the Shulchan Aruch who says that chituch only helps if it's Derech Avodah, if any idiot could do it?
Any idiot could be mechadish his own Derech Avodah.
Right. So then everything in effect is. Why would it ever be mutter according to the Shulchan Aruch?
So if you were to listen to what I said earlier, then Shvirus Makel is talking about a person did without any kavanah. If a person is mechadish that the Derech HaAvodah is by Shvirus Makel, of course it's always going to be aser. If a person goes ahead and goes in front of any Avodah Zarah and breaks a stick without kavanah, it's only going to be aser if it's something that they shake a stick in front of it. It's something that they bepoil do. If people bepoil believe that you're meant to be Avodah Zarah by cutting its hair, then that's Derech HaAvodah. If no one would ever believe that you're meant to cut its hair in front of Avodah Zarah, then fine. If people bepoil believe it, then it's for sure Derech HaAvodah.
And there's one last thing. There's a few other things here, but just
about
them to be
And then about the Kravitz Avodah Zarah being Aser Min HaTorah or not. So the Shara Melech actually brings from four or five Gemaras that the Mavur that it's an Isser Derech. So that's the Shita of the Rambam, the Ramban, the Ran, the Rabbeinu Yoina, the Mukhi Yosef, Taisus, and quite a few places. And then there's basically Zichur Rav Rishayim hold that way. There is a there's a stira in the Rashi what the Rashi holds. The Rashi in Kedushin Daf Nun Ches Taka Mitzadeh that is the Rabbanon, and Taisus and Bava Kama and Beis is also Mesubik on that. But Lamaisa, the Shara Melech explains how Taisus is going Shloika Hilchas, is going in Chitas Chizkiya, and we don't pass him like that. And as far as the Rashi, the Rashi in Teres Abayis by Nagei Yainesach explains that the Krevitz is Aser Min HaTorah, and the Klal is there's a stira between the Rashi and Kedushim and the stira and the Rashi in Teres Abayis. Halacha is like the Rashi in Teres Abayis. The Seichem says that in quite a few other Achayim. So, Pashtus, there's no such reason to hold that the Kravitz Avodah Zarah is not Aser Min HaTorah.
I think the Marshal and the Taz, both of them are like the Shara Melech too.
If you want to know the Achrayim that say that, it's, the Marshal, there's no riot, the Marshal or the Taz hold the Rabbanan. All they do is they give a reason why the Kravitz Avodah Zarah is more chamer than Avodah Zarah. So there's b'chlal no raya that they're saying it's the Rabbanan. There's no reason to assume that they're saying it's the Rabbanan, especially since Rav Yishreinim and Rav Rechreinim, the Mishnah Balach, Shara Melech, Divrei Emes, Beis Halevi, Shuvas Tuv Tamadas, Rosh Hashanah Kluger, the Chazanish, Yerdeh Semen Samach, most Achreinim, all Neman that it's the Raisa. And even if you go ahead and say it's the Rabbanan, you go ahead and on that side, Rabbi Kiva Eger and Chul and Yergim Omer Beis says that even on that
hello,
side,
and the Prisha learns that way in the Marshal and the Taz.
And Zechar, Rav Yishreinim and Rav Rechreinim hold one way. It's very hard to go ahead and make a diuk. They know because the preacher says a reason, that the preacher really holds their abundance. Very shvach, very shvach.
And let me ask you another thing. According to this svara from Rabbi Donna, that the people are over that way, even though they don't know what they're doing. Do you have like any numerical number as to what percentage of the people are doing it that way?
No idea. I mean, I think that if you go on a Google result, the first 40 results say you have a whole story with here, then it's for sure most of them are doing. The only Makaris that we're having are the same doctors and professors who were saying in 2004 is the only Makaris Farkar, then I have no idea how many people it is. But as I said, that the Pasha doesn't make a difference because Avodah Zarah's Pasha is not telling the reasons, and anything that's Derech Avodah Zarah, then it should be Aser, without any reason why they're doing it.
Rabbi Friedman, it's been wonderful having you on. Thank you so much. Okay, take care. Bye-bye. We have the honor of having with us on the phone Professor Emma Tarlow, who's a professor at the University of London. She's an anthropologist and has spent more than 30 years researching Hindi religions and spent 4 years researching the human hair shaving, tonsuring, and sales. Welcome, Professor Tarlow.
Thank you very much.
So, Professor Tarlow, I'm an Orthodox Jew.
Yes.
And you know that one of the big brouhahas in our world is, you know, is the hair that comes, that's bought in China, basically shipped from a lot of Hindu temples, is the purpose of the hair when they go to the temple to get the hair shaved, is it as a sacrifice to the deity, similar to like you would give, one of their customs is to give candy to the deity, they give all kinds of, you know, monetary gifts, etc., or is it about cleansing, i.e. it's a prerequisite. Before you come to the deity, shave off ego, shave off pride, remove dirt, they get washed, etc. We're trying to find out, according to Hindi theology, in particular Tirumala theology, which is it, A or B? So that's a very, I'm cutting straight to the point here, but I'm wondering if you could share with us some of your extensive knowledge as far as interviewing, etc.
Yes, thank you. Well, I've visited several Hindu temples where people undergo the ritual of tonsure. And what's important to understand is that you do not have this tonsure performed inside the temple itself. You go to a special barber hall, it's called a tonsuring hall, and you have your head shaved prior to going into the temple. And when you go into the temple to worship, you don't take with you the hair that's been removed because your hair is considered a sort of polluting substance. It's a body substance that's been removed from a head. And part of that removal is the idea of cleansing, but it's also the idea of renouncing worldly things, your attachment to the world. So that hair falls to the ground and is taken off for sorting and processing, and it's sold into the wig industry. Whereas the person who's going to worship the god would first take a ritual bath after being shaved and then go into the temple. And what they would offer in the temple is things like flowers and fruits. They would not offer human hair. That would be considered very inappropriate.
Well, so, Professor, is this widely accepted among the theologians, is there a disagreement about it? Like,
for Hindu theologians, that would be clear, you know, and when people go to worship in temples, people, you know, as I say, they offer flowers and fruits, things that are pleasing and pure, and they would certainly not offer human hair. So the human hair is kept separate and it's removed outside the actual building of the temple. So any expert in Hinduism and theologian within the Hindu tradition would tell you that. And in fact, in relation to the controversy that there was about hair from Indian temples that was quite a big controversy in 2004, prior to that, back in the 1980s, people from the Orthodox Jewish community had consulted experts of Hinduism, including practicing Hindu priests, who had all told them that, in fact, which is why they had initially made the decision not to ban the hair. It was only later in 2004 that this anxiety about this connection of hair and the perception of it being some kind of sacrifice to the gods in that sense became popularized. And it was at that point that anxiety about Indian hair
So, Professor, let me ask you a question, okay?
Mm-hmm.
in 2004, what happened was a fellow from England, the Rabbi
yes.
Donner, went
yeah.
The temple at Tirumala, and
yes.
He brought with him, from what I understand, a translator who Tamil was his third language.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like two people. It was like if I would speak to you in Tamil, basically, or
yeah.
yet, sort of like my Spanish.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
But he came back, and what he claimed is as follows. He said, "It could be that the theologians believe that,
mm-hmm.
but the mass majority of the people are totally ignorant,
mm-hmm.
and they are not doing it for the appropriate theological reason. They are mistakenly doing it as a sacrifice, and to prove that, we spoke to 10 people who are coming out, and mm-hmm. they all, you know, the translator speaking his third language, to them speaking, they were speaking in Hindi, which was the other party's third language. They said, no, the people who are going actually believe it as a sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound like a reasonable possibility to you?
Well, I think what you're pointing out here is something which is very interesting, is that religious experts with, you know, extreme theological knowledge, which you have very much within Judaism and you also have within Hinduism, do not necessarily say the same thing as ordinary people who are less educated. That is for sure, you know, within specific religious interpretive traditions. So what is true is that when people go to the temple, they have a sense that, you know, they're offering something, but they're not... So all depends then on what you mean by offering and what you mean by sacrifice. But from my understanding of Orthodox Jewish law, and I have discussed this with various rabbis, an offering or a sacrifice is conceptualized as sort of laying the thing in front of the idol. And in that sense, it's absolutely not a sacrifice in the theological sense of the term. But people who go to have their head shaved have different motivations. So one motivation is a lot of people bring very small children, and it's their first shaving of the head. And the first shaving of the head is like it's considered like a transition into, you know, the next stage of life. So it's an important ritual passage, if you like. Other people go because they've made a vow to God that if something good happens, like they've passed their exams, or you know, a business has gone particularly well, or someone's recovered from illness, then they will go and they will give up their hair and then go and worship the gods. So these are the kind of contexts in which people go to the temples.
Professor, it's fair to say that from a theological point of view, it's absolute that the way you described it is correct. Any intelligent theologian would say it's removal of an impurity rather than a sacrifice. But it's also fair to say that when people are ignorant, heaven knows, they could be thinking anything, and it's pretty hard to actually know. Is that fair to say?
I would say it's always fair to say that you can never tell exactly what is going on in somebody's head, and that would be true of everybody, whether they're educated or not.
Yes, okay.
In that sense, that's true.
Okay, so Professor, let me ask you another question. We had on a rabbi from Israel last night who's researching this, and his findings were rather interesting. He said that the temple in Tirumala is sent a fraction of the amount of hair that is cut off in India to China. I think he said it's 12%, using what Tirumala publishes and using what the UN Commerce Guide publishes.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, even if Rabbi Donner is correct, and it's every one of these people got it all wrong. Mm. And by the way, and there's a question. Let me just finish my point, Professor.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, as an aside, we are struggling with, well, if they got it all wrong, does that make it a sacrifice? Like if somebody, you know, goes to Buckingham Palace and shaves their hair off because they think that's what the Queen likes, you're not bringing a sacrifice. You're actually, they're going to lock you up in the nut house.
Mm-hmm.
So who establishes what sacrifice is a different question in Judaism.
Mm.
But my question would be, if he's correct and it's only 12% of the hair, brought into China, so then there is a concept of, you know, you go after the majority and a minority would just become, you know, become sort of integrated into the majority without any consequences. As somebody who, ironically, is an expert on hair imports, do these numbers make sense to you?
They do. In fact, I'm surprised it's that much. I know that it's a small percent, very small percentage that would go from the temples to China, because the vast majority of that hair from the temples is auctioned by e-auction to very specific big hair importers for the sort of high-end hair extension market in Europe and the United States. So very, very little of it is bought up by Chinese factories, because they prefer to work with much cheaper hair sources. And the hair that is sold by the Hindu temples is actually very expensive by comparison to many of the other sources of hair.
So where does the other hair come from? Like, if I understand for tonsuring, people are willing to let go of a beautiful head of hair. Who else in India is having their hair shaved, and what would be the reason?
So there are two different things that are happening. Actually, between 70 and 80% of the hair that India exports is not hair that's been shaved from the head. It's actually hair that's fallen out when people are brushing and combing their hair. It's called combings in the trade. And that hair is collected up door to door. So you have peddlers who go around door to door calling out for hair. And people will sell like a year's worth of hair for about the equivalent of $1. And all of that hair has to be then untangled in untangling workshops, goes through a huge amount of different processes before it then gets sent to China. And that provides a very large bulk of the hair that's used in wigs and extensions. It's not the most superior hair, because it's tangled up, so it's not what they call Remy hair in the hair trade, but it is the bulk of what is being exported from India to China. And it's completely outside of any religious context. It's just hair that's fallen out whilst you're brushing or washing your hair.
So, Professor, let me follow up with this question.
If I could also just point out, because I don't want to give any misconceptions, there's also hair collected from people who sell their hair out of poverty. And that hair is coming from places like Myanmar. It's coming from places like China itself. So there are poor women around Asia who sell, you know, who have very long hair, who'll often have their hair cut maybe to sort of shoulder length, and the long part that's being cut off, they will sell for money, and that also goes into the wig industry and the hair extension industry.
So, Professor, what would you say to the following supposition? There's a number of ways they get here. One is from the hair combings, which is more inferior.
Yes.
One is from Tiramula, where it's superior. If a person is buying a very expensive hair piece,
mm-hmm.
Like you have a wealthy person that's spending $3,000 on a hairpiece.
Yes.
Would you say that there's a greater likelihood than not that it's coming from Tiramula, or that it's coming from somewhere else?
There are many places it could come from, because it could come from somewhere else. It could come. It could also come from Europe. There are some Russian and Ukrainian people who sell their hair also for money, even Romania. It is likely the expensive, well-made wigs that you're talking about are likely to be made from what is called Remy hair. In other words, they won't be made from the combings. They'll be made from hair that has been cut from a person's head. So, for example, in Myanmar, I saw people selling their hair in the market, and I interviewed people there, and I saw also in factories in China, because I've also visited the factories in China, that they have sources of hair, such as, you know, very long, unprocessed, never been chemically treated, never been dyed or anything, hair that they've bought from Myanmar, and they can use that for expensive wigs. And in my experience, I didn't meet wig makers in China who were using hair from Hindu temples, actually. And since writing the book, I've actually had a lot of correspondence with people from the Orthodox Jewish community, including correspondence from the Kashrus authorities for the chief rabbi of Bnei Brak, Rabbi Lamda.
And how did he come out? Do you know how he came out?
I know that he considers that it is perfectly acceptable for people to use Indian hair, that it does not contravene Jewish law for Jewish women to wear Indian hair that has been gathered from temples such as Tirumala. That is his position on that.
Well, Professor Tarlo, thank you so much for enlightening us on this very entangled issue. And I urge all of our listeners to purchase your book, Entanglement, The Secret Lives of Hair. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.
We have the honor of having with us from Tellstone in Eretz Yisrael, Rabbi Mordechai Kuber, I personally owe Akaras HaTov to him. He's one of the authors of the Schottenstein Shas. He's worked on many of the Masechtas, Makis, Erevin, Bat Metzias, Shavuos, etc. He also wrote a Sefer on Eilu Treifis. He was one of the foremost authorities on why we're able to eat fish today, because he was one of those who are matir, the worms that come in the fish that other, you know, many Paiskim, was a big brouhaha about it many years ago. He was the Rav for many years in Paramus and Adas Yishurun. Today he's a Rav in Kal Nachlas Tzvi in Telstone. He's also one of the Rabbanim of the OU. That's a very long introduction. Welcome, Rabbi Kuber.
Good evening.
Good evening. So Rabbi Kuber, could you tell us a little bit about the hair that comes from India that's used, maybe, you know, some of it in Shetlach, and the essence of what your research and halacha on this topic?
Okay, I'd like to begin, I think, before we get involved in the discussion, the halachic details of whether the hair that they're shaving off in the temples in India before they have their yechidus, their private time with the deity over there. But before we get to that, I think it's important to understand whether there's really a concern here about the presence of Indian hair in the Shetlach at all. Clearly, if the Indian hair doesn't make it, or it doesn't make it in quantity, then the discussion really ends there. We could safely presume that it's from the Rove and it's not a Vodazar. So before we get involved in halacha, I think it's important to understand whether there is a concern for the Indian hair in the global market, or specifically the Chinese market, which is a major supplier of wigs and processed hair and everything else for the industry. Instead of dwelling on the incorrect way to analyze them, we're going to try to take a look at the figures and see what they tell us about the presence of temple hair in the global market. Now, the primary...
Rabbi Kuber, can
yes.
I interrupt you?
Certainly.
What's your expertise in this Indian? Could you tell us a little bit about the research you've done, et cetera? Like, what have you done in this? You obviously have done research. Have you written about it? Just so that our Olam understands that.
Okay, well, this is was one of my, perhaps even say, front burner projects of things to write about. I do sit in the Mir Yeshiva when I'm not overseas for the OU, and which is Baruch Hashem most of the time. And for some reason, I am somewhat of a lightning rod for the various conflicts. The United Nations publishes annually a commerce report of global trade, and the most recent publication is for the year 2016. And in that publication, they have figures for global export, global import, and we have their figures for global export from India of hair products and global import by all sorts of nations, including China, their sources. And just to make a long story short, China imports from India around 2,782 metric tons of hair product a year. Now, what this hair product we're talking about means, it's India is giving them human hair. That's the kind of hair they have to give. They're not producing synthetic hair in India. But it has different grades. Different grades. India has a 5-grade system. The grade number one is 31 inches and longer for really long Shetlach and things like that. Grade number two is 16 to 30 inches. Grade number three is 10 to 15. Grade number four is 5 to 10, and grade number five is below that, cuttings below that. Now, a shetel, at a minimum, a shoulder-length shetel, needs hair that's 10 inches long at a minimum. To make that 25 centimeters is 10 inches long to make that hair. So we're basically talking about, in terms of the shetel suitable hair that comes out of India, it's grades 1, 2, and 3. Grades 1, 2, and 3 are what's suitable Shetel here. Now, the temple, the main temple in Tirupati, which is the main center for the hair. If you do a search for where Indian temples have hair, this is what comes up. No one else comes up. I've seen different figures. This is 60% of the temple hair, but my sense is it's quite a bit more. And they have auctions every month of their hair, and they do publish the figures. From the figures of the first 3 months of this year, January, February, and March, I was, and the sales figures and everything, I don't want to bore everyone with all the details here, but in terms of grades 1, 2, and 3, Shetel suitable hair, and that multiplied by 4 to give us an annual number, it came out to around 85 metric tons, annual figure, 85 metric tons of hair. Now, just as a reference point, a shetel needs around 350, 330 grams of hair. So you're talking about for every kilogram, you get 3 shetels, and a ton is 3,000 shetels. So that's 85 times 3,000 shetels worth of hair. But back to the figure, 85 metric tons a year, and at a total take for the temple of $15.5 million around. Now, I went ahead and, based on the different proportions of that hair, you'll see why in a moment, I made myself a weighted average of what they're getting per kilogram of that hair, and they're getting $181 per kilogram as a weighted average. Okay, now, why is that important? Because in China, which is the main concern, that's where everyone's getting their shetlach, the, shall we say, over-the-counter shetlach, they import from India, as we said, 2,782 metric tons a year at a cost of $133 million and change. Now, there are grades 4 and grades 5, and grade 5 is sold in quantity. Those are little cuttings. But when you work all this out, it comes out that if China only imported the shetel-length hair and didn't even import grades 4 and 5, which certainly they are importing, but if because they make hair extensions and other things, other hair products and eyebrow pieces and all sorts of other hair pieces that aren't shetels, shetlach. But in the end of the day, if they were to import only shetel-length hair, it would come out that they would need to cover that dollar figure. They'd need to import 736 metric tons a year of hair from India. The more lower-grade hair they have, that means the more shetel-length hair they have to import to cover that. So I would, taking these figures, I would guess that they probably import around 900 metric tons of shetel-length hair a year from India, which means that 85 metric tons doesn't come close to being the figure that that's not even Rove.
I didn't follow the math there. You're saying that. Just sum it up.
Let me give percentages, and then
okay.
You can follow it. Yeah.
Yeah.
For guessing on from China's dollar figure of imports a year from India, how much shetel-length hair would have to be in there to cover it? Because the other grades of hair that aren't shetel-length cost pennies in terms of this stuff. It's the difference in price is tremendous.
Right.
So when we look at that figure, that figure is basically paying for shetel-length hair.
Right.
Because however much they get from the other stuff doesn't raise that dollar figure terribly at all. They get tons and tons of it and maybe cost $1 million. So we're basically looking at shetel-length hair covering that. And then taking the weighted average I have, you're looking at anywhere between 750 and 900 metric tons of shetel-length hair that China is importing from India. And the temple is selling all their global sales, which don't all go to China, providing 85 metric tons a year.
So you're saying it's almost it would be like 12%. You're saying.
Well, 15. Let's make it 20. But it's nowhere near Roe
so
of the Indian here.
Yeah. So that's absurd. That's a DOA to any tine, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what I think. I mean, I'll be happy to discuss with you the Lumdis, the Avodah Zarah discussion too. But I think it's always important to have a proper context. Now we're in the tonsuring salon where the devotees get their head shaven, and one of the questions that the Rabbanim dealt with 15 years ago, the shluchim of the Rabbanim who came to visit, one of the things they dealt with was what is the intention of these devotees as they're having their head shaven? Do they think they're doing some kind of act of service of the deity, or what's in their minds? And now the hair is shaved because of some Indians have all Avodah Zarah is, of course, Narishkeit and silly. So there's no reason to think this is sillier than anything else. But in a nutshell, their dear deity one day was having some fight with a shepherd who gave him a whack on his head and took off some of his hair. And some princess was standing by, and she was so concerned about the bald spot on this deity's head that she yanked her own hair out and gave it to him as a hair transplant. And he was so moved by the princess's kind, benevolent, generous act that he promised that whoever would offer him the hair, he would make sure that it gets returned to the princess. Seder. So therefore, when they go there, let's take the worst case scenario instead of arguing about what they're thinking, what they're not thinking. Is it an act of subservience, or are they just thinking they're being mavatil, their gaiva and their haughtiness? Now, they get their head shaven. Where they get their shaven, the deity itself sits in the temple. They don't get tonsured in the temple. They're outside the temple in the tonsure building, a multi-story, multi-zillion barber place, which until recently did not have any statues in it. Apparently they erected a new facility and they did put a statue in it. The statue is not clearly visible to everybody, but we'll discuss that in a moment. And they get their hair cut, and then they bathe, and then they stand in line for 10 hours. And then eventually they get their 4 seconds of private time with the grand deity who's inside of the temple. Their hair, when they get it, they don't bring in their hair. And their hair is dumped in a box, which is called a hundi. Hundi is just a means of financial encumbrance, and that's what the hundi was. So this box here, I agree with what was told you, but that doesn't mean garbage can, but it means a donation box. It means a way of effecting a financial transfer. That's a hundi, or financial encumbrance. So when they put in the hundi, that basically seals the donation to the temple. It's not an altar. It's not a mizbeach. No one is burning incense or anything else in the tonsuring rooms. It just means that they have now sealed their donation to
temple. It's a metal box. If you actually Google it, the word H-U-N-D-I, meaning in Hindi, it shows a metal box that says the word hundi on it.
That's the current incarnation of it.
Rabbi Kuber, the Meiri on Dafnun Aleph says that any kind of a geziza would be the equivalent of shechita, which means that cutting of hair then would be a type of shechita, which one of the four avodas, but that's his exact lashon. So he says, you say it is as a din of a shechita, and they're cutting the hair.
Well, he's talking... Frankly, the Meiri talks about two things. He talks about cutting coins, minting, cutting the metal for coins, and cutting the horns off of a para. We're a little ahead of ourselves, but the point is nothing is avodah zarah. You're just referring to the technical details of how we make something be like slaughtering and zvicha, but which we haven't really gotten to yet. The first thing is, does the person, the devotee, mean to serve the deity in this fashion? If he doesn't mean to, then it's not avodah zarah, no matter what he's doing, right? It has to be when a person pours water on his hands in the temple. That's a nice nisuch, right? But that's not avodah zarah. He's washing his hands, cleansing himself of avodah zarah, but it has to be an act of service. So whether or not it's technically an act of shvira or a mein zvicha, which is what you were saying before, but we're not up to that yet. We first have to know if this is an act of service. And the truth is that Mr. Deity, never asked them to shave their heads in devotion to him. All he asked for is the hair. He didn't ask them to shave their heads. Shaving the head, if the guy walks in there, shaves his head, then takes his hair with him, they'll jump on him. They'll lynch him. They just gave him a free haircut, expecting he's going to put the hair. They gave him free breakfast and free lodging and everything, expecting they're going to get his hair and be able to sell it. If you don't give them the hair, then the guy with the bald spot and the princess who yanked out her hair, they ain't going to get their hair. So if anything, we would have to analyze whether the act of putting their hair in a hundi is some kind of tikrobis. But shaving the head is not a avodah zarah, because the person, it's not in their tradition at all that this is an act of avodah zarah. It's not meant to be. And what's important for them is the hair itself. You can't serve this guy by getting a haircut. Even if you're doing it l'shem the getchka, don't work. So I think this is another hole in the entire argument, rather large hole, about everyone gets involved in technicalities of is it shvira, is it this, is it that, when that. But before you get there, he has to be intending that he should be serving a deity like this. And that's not in their lore at all.
Thank you very much. It's been an honor, Rabbi Kuber, having you on with us.
Okay, have a good evening.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
All the best. Bye-bye.